This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal, and I'm Stephen Henderson. I'm in the studio with Carrie Jr. II, who is the show's producer. Hey, Carrie.
One of these days, I want to introduce myself after you the way you introduce yourself.
What?
Like, and I'm
what does that mean?
Carrie Jr. I'm Carrie Jr. II.
It's my radio voice.
It's your radio voice. I was a little brother of two older sisters. So you know,
always were getting introduced by other people?
I tease. But we love your radio voice, Stephen. Sorry.
Well, that's what they pay me to do on this show is
and
have
you do
a radio
well.
Voice.
And you do it well.
So today we are talking with somebody who is a real idol of mine, actually. I spent years and years as a young journalist covering education. And then the name Gary Orfield was just synonymous with expert in the field of desegregation and schools, somebody who had spent decades researching how the country desegregated its schools and was a real thinker about how we did it, why we did it, and what effect it had. So today we're going to talk about new research he has that shows where we are in 2024.
I kind of feel like we're going back in time, but we're still talking about the present day. Because what his research has found, which piqued our interest, is that we're not the same, but we have, our schools are almost as segregated as they were back in, I think it was like 60s or 70s.
1968.
So yeah. That's, you know, after Brown v. Board, that was after they started already busing students and black students to other schools.
Yeah.
And there was an integration effort that we saw progressing, and now we've kind of regressed.
And the pattern is different. I mean, Brown v. Board of Education was directed largely at the South, where segregation was still the law in 1954. Mm-hmm. It gets implemented in the late 1960s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And now what we see is that segregated schools are mostly in the North. Mm-hmm. And in the South, schools are more desegregated. So that's one of the things we'll want to talk to him about is what that means, why it happened, and sort of how we reconcile those two things.
Well, let's see what Orfield has to say about that.
Yeah. Dr. Gary Orfield, welcome to Created Equal.
Great to be with you.
Yeah. So I want to start with just the title of this study, The Unfinished Battle for Integration in a Multiracial America from Brown to Now. You make some really bold conclusions about our journey to integrated schools in this report. Tell us what you found.
Well, we found that the struggle for Brown, of course, started with the Brown decision itself in 1954. It was fiercely opposed. Mm-hmm. It applied mostly to the South and mostly to black students rather than a multiracial idea. It was 10 years after Brown, 98% of black students were still in completely segregated schools. Mm-hmm. And there were virtually no black teachers teaching white students across the 17 states that had segregation by law. Only after the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed did we really get integration. And then we got a lot of integration over the Johnson administration periods when this law was actually enforced.
Mm-hmm.
The South went from almost absolute segregation to become the most integrated part of the United States. The rest of the country was pretty much left out of the considerations until almost 20 years after Brown, when the Supreme Court said you could get desegregation orders in the North and in the West,
mm-hmm.
and we should include Latino students as well as black students. That's the period in which the big northern cities began to get involved in the desegregation process. It was never enforced actively by most of the governments that were in charge. The Republican governments, beginning with Richard Nixon,
mm-hmm.
were opposed to school desegregation. So it's kind of left to the courts to do it. And in places like Detroit and other big cities in the North, that was basically a city by city battle. And very soon it ran up against the problem of the fact that by the time the courts finally got around to desegregating the North, there weren't very many white students left in many of the central city school districts because of the tremendous flight of whites to the suburbs, which happened before desegregation, not afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when we got to the problem of what do we do about the metropolitan areas? Do we deal with the city by itself, or do we have to include the suburbs? And in Detroit, of course, the judge decided there was no way you can deal with the city by itself because the city was already about three quarters non-white, changing fast, and in a huge crisis caused by the scandal of the Nixon administration period housing policies that really decimated neighborhoods all over Detroit and a number of big cities in the North.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, the court in Detroit, which was where you had a conservative federal judge, looked at the situation and said, there's no way we can do this inside the city. The only way we can do it is to include the suburbs in the remedy.
Right.
And that produced a huge, huge constitutional fight.
Yes.
With President Nixon threatened to change the Constitution if that order was carried out. Huge pressure was put on the Supreme Court. And by a 5-4 decision, they decided to separate the city and the suburbs for desegregation purposes. And that, as Thurgood Marshall said in his dissent in the Milliken case, that was the end of desegregation for a lot of millions of Black students and Latino students who were in overwhelmingly poor, overwhelmingly non-white Central City school districts.
Yeah, yeah. And if you fast forward from that era, the 70s, to now, some of what you find in this study is that we have slipped back in large ways to the time of segregation, that our schools today, in terms of their racial makeup, don't look fundamentally different than they did in the late 1960s.
That's right. They are different than they looked in the 1950s because in the South, we did have a lot of desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
And that really lasted till the late 1980s. And the South is still more integrated than the Midwest and the North. So we didn't, where it was done, it tended to last. It tended to have pretty large benefits, as it turns out. It really wasn't done in a lot of places, like the Detroit Metro, and like most of the Middle West, Chicago, a number of other big cities. It just never happened.
Yeah.
There was some compensatory education money, which came out in Detroit for 12 years, and the court just gave up. The judge actually told us he didn't know anything he could do that would work.
Yeah, yeah. And let's talk about what's happened in the North in particular over that time, this this kind of resegregation, the retrenching of the efforts to integrate schools. What are the things that you're looking at that tell you this is not working, that this is not making any progress?
Well, what our data shows is that the high point of desegregation for the country came in the late 1980s. In 1991, the Supreme Court, which had become much more conservative by this time, the conservatives of the majority of Republican appointees had controlled the Supreme Court already for 30 years. Early 1990s, the Supreme Court decided to dissolve the desegregation plans that were in place. So where there had been desegregation, the court said, that's enough. We don't have to continue that. We can just go back to whatever the local authorities want to do. And ever since then, in every part of the country, segregation has been growing. And right now, it's extremely high in many places. Here in California, for example, the average Latino student was in a majority white school in 1970. They're now in a school that's about 85% non-white and extremely poor. The segregation that we see, the increasing segregation that we see, is not just segregation by race, it's segregation by race plus poverty. The schools that Black and Latino students go to have a substantial majority of poor kids on average. And the schools that whites and Asians go to have a significant majority of middle-class kids. And they perform much, much better. And they get better teachers. They get richer curriculum, higher levels of completion, college going, many other long-term effects.
Yeah. And this is, as you see it, a function or an outcome that is driven by the retreat from school desegregation. It is not necessarily about other kinds of segregation that have persisted. In other words, the housing segregation that exists.
Well, housing has always had an important role.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have had to do school desegregation if we didn't have housing segregation.
Yeah.
It would have just happened. So, and housing segregation is most extreme in a few cities in the country, including Metro Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have extreme housing segregation, plus you have lots of small independent suburban school districts, you get school segregation. And if you don't do something, nobody's really seriously enforced housing integration policies, although housing segregation or housing discrimination has been illegal since 1968. There hasn't been much enforcement, and it still exists on a really serious scale.
Yeah, yeah. Before we move on, I want to talk just a little about the rationale for integrated schools, beyond sort of a moral case to be made that segregation's wrong and that integration is more reflective of the American ideal. What are the other reasons that we believe that integration of schools matters for Black and brown children? What are the things that we expect to happen when we see that?
People need to understand what schools are. Schools are groups of students interacting with teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens that the best and most experienced teachers go to the most privileged schools. And that's a really important factor. Another factor that deeply influences student learning is classmates. If you're in a school with lots of well-prepared classmates, the instruction goes on at a much higher level and you learn from each other as well as from the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
That's the nature of a great college. If you go to the University of Michigan, you're going to be in classes with expert professors, and you're going to be in classes with lots of well-trained students, and you're going to learn a lot in class and out of class. In poor schools, poor segregated schools that are doubly separated, both from white population and from middle-class population, you don't get those connections. And the way teachers get assigned, teachers, when they get seniority, get the right to transfer, and they usually transfer to more privileged schools.
Mm-hmm.
The inexperienced teachers get assigned to high poverty, non-white schools in very many cases, and they're not prepared to really deal with the challenges that those students are facing all the time in families that are struggling, in communities that are struggling. The schools have an enormous job to do, and we put the least experienced people in charge of it.
Yeah, but that's an awful big burden to put on schools, isn't it? I mean, the problems that you're describing aren't about schools fundamentally. They're about other dynamics in our country that draw the best teachers to the wealthiest and whitest districts and you know, afford resources to those. Why do we put so much, I guess, on schools?
You know, everybody wants the best for their kids.
Mm-hmm.
All communities want the best for themselves, and they compete with other communities. If everybody tries to maximize their power and their opportunities, the people who are most connected and have the most resources get the best opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
In our society, we don't redistribute income. We try to equalize opportunity, and the schools are supposed to do it, but we provide the worst schools to the students who need the schools most and rely on the schools most. Poor kids are much more influenced by schools than middle-class kids, who are much more influenced by their families and their communities. So what we do is we run a school system that's the only option for mobility for many young people. And we give the least chance and a path that isn't really well articulated towards college. If we're going to break this up, we have to make a decision that we want it to come out differently.
Yeah.
And if we look at the dynamics of our cities, we realize that the people who are going to inherit our cities and our society are majority non-white. What do we do if we don't figure out a way to connect people, to help them understand each other and to share opportunities fairly?
Yeah.
That's what school desegregation fight is about. It's focused on the schools because we don't really want to do anything about redistributing income or seriously redistributing employment. And we don't want to change housing that much. Schools are the one instrument that we have that reaches 90% of our young people. And it's the place where the battle has focused. And, you know, we've kind of given up on it.
Right.
The courts have decided that we're not going to push it. So we don't have any system, any plan. And that there's going to be tremendous cost to our society if we do not have a plan as it goes through these huge changes that it's undergoing now.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Gary Orfield about schools and integration. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
We're back with more Created Equal, and we're talking with Gary Orfield, a researcher at the University of California at Los Angeles. Before we broke, Dr. Orfield, you were about to say something about the value of integration.
You know, the really good thing about school integration is that it's not really that hard to do, and it has big benefits. The research for the last 50 years shows that really disadvantaged kids gain a lot from being in a diverse school. It really changes their lives in many ways, increases their chances of going to college, changes what kind of job and income they get. It has all kinds of influences on their lives. And the advantage of it is that it doesn't do anything to harm more privileged kids. There's very powerful research for the last 50 years that shows that privileged kids don't lose and disadvantaged kids gain in integrated schools. So it is a win-win.
Yeah.
But people don't believe it. People are afraid their children are going to lose.
Right.
But they don't lose, and they do gain in the sense that they learn how to operate in a multiracial, multi-class society, which is a huge advantage given what our future society is going to look like.
Yeah.
So we have a win-win system that has been made into a lose-lose system by the politics and by extremely conservative courts that have thrown away a lot of the tools that we can use to accomplish this.
Yeah. You said something there I want to go back to. You said it's not that hard to do. What do you mean by that?
I mean what the kids actually get along. They find it interesting. The problem where it's really hard is the people in the community.
The adults.
And interesting that the research shows that the families of kids who's in schools that are actually integrated say it's a positive experience. It's the people who aren't in those schools who think it's a terrible, awful development that's fearful and that's harmful. But the people actually experience it find it to be quite positive. But the politics of it are ugly. People are mobilized against this by fears.
Yeah. I mean, that reminds me of a quote from Dr. King that goes to the idea that we distrust each other and dislike each other because we fear each other, and we fear each other because we don't know each other. I mean, you just kind of summed up that quote right there.
Well, that's right. One of the experiences of school desegregation, where it occurs, especially if it occurs with good leadership, is that people of different racial backgrounds discover that they want the same things. They really are afraid of each other, and they learn that they want the same things. And that's a powerful experience for families and for people in communities that do experience successful desegregation.
Yeah.
One of the problems right now is that most of our racial change is going on in suburban rings. One of our recent studies shows that if you take the 25 largest metros in the country, the majority of the kids in the suburban rings of those areas are non-white.
Mm-hmm.
But they're getting segregated in the suburbs. And nobody's really doing anything to make it come out differently.
Yeah, that's actually where I wanted to go next. This idea of what's changed demographically in America since 1968. So here in Detroit, for instance, the city has been majority Black, at least by census, since 1980. And the suburbs were almost all white still at that point. But on the 2020 census, one of the things we learned was that the majority of African Americans who live in Metro Detroit now live outside the city of Detroit. They live in suburbs, and of course, the city is even more heavily African American than it was in 1980. I mean, it's still somewhere around 78, I think, percent. But that phenomenon where you have Black families moving to the suburbs, moving to communities that by definition are at least a little more integrated than the city is, what effect has that had on school integration, and why?
It's really important people understand this. Beginning in the 1970s, Black families began to move out from central cities.
Mm-hmm.
And now in many metros, the large majority of middle-class Black families are in the suburbs. And that's true for Latinos as well. And the suburbs are becoming very multiracial. The problem is nothing is being done to integrate the kids and the communities as this happens. So the risk is that we resegregate suburb by suburb, community by community, just the stupid way we did with our central cities. And the individual communities become predominantly non-white and then they become predominantly poor. And all of the middle-class people try to flee from them. Including the middle-class people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a destructive process that's really been going on for more than a century in our metro areas and is now getting well into the suburbs. There's no other place to run for most people. We ought to figure out how to stay and to be together. To integrate and keep those places integrated, we need plans. And we need regionalism.
Mm-hmm.
That in as we go through racial change in the suburbs. Why don't we enforce fair housing so that we don't steer all these Black families and Latino families into these places that are resegregating? Why don't we put our subsidized housing in in places that have really good schools instead of using them in a way that increases segregation of schools.
So I guess one of the things I'm getting at, though, is if there are more African Americans living in the suburbs, and I mean, there are some examples of suburbs that have become majority African American here in Detroit, and of course, you know, as blacks move into those places, we're seeing the same thing that happened in the city when African Americans started to move around. But it seems, though, like there is a greater opportunity for school integration in the suburbs because, you know, many of the communities are multiracial. There are African Americans, there are Latinos, there are Asians, there are white families, all living in the same technical jurisdiction. So is that more conducive to integration? Is that in those areas, are we seeing better school integration? And if not, why not?
Well, we're seeing it, but lots of times it's transitional.
Okay.
To make it last, we have to have a plan to make it last.
Okay.
That includes both school and housing plan. So what we see, for example, is housing that's being marketed in areas where the schools are changing racially is being shown to black families and Latino families. It isn't being shown to white families or right. many Asian families. We need to make sure the real estate market doesn't work in a way that resegregates communities and that helps them remain interracial. Communities need to be active about that and get on top of that so that it doesn't happen to them, because that's what happens to communities that go through resegregation.
Mm-hmm.
So, planners need to think about where they put their subsidized housing so it doesn't make this process work in a destructive way. We need to think about this to get a different outcome. It won't happen by itself. The advantage of suburbs is there is a lot of diversity right now. The disadvantage is there isn't a plan, and these are small communities, so they can go through resegregation pretty fast if nothing is done.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little about busing, which for a time was the primary tool of desegregation in the North, at least, right? And I want to talk about some of the practices that accompanied busing, right? So you send, first of all, the idea that who's going to ride the bus, right? I remember being a big issue that white families were less comfortable with the idea of their kids riding buses into black neighborhoods than people were comfortable sending black kids into white neighborhoods. And I'm going to talk about the outcomes that were produced by the burden of integration that was placed on African Americans in so many cases. I mean, it seems to me that it wasn't a genuine attempt at integration. It was an attempt to comply with a court that said you had to integrate, but to do it in a way that put the least amount of pressure on one side of the equation, which of course doesn't produce an equal outcome.
Yeah, well, a couple of things are important for people to think about. We haven't had any orders that require mandatory student transfers, which was what produces what George Wallace and Richard Nixon decided to be called busing rather than integration. Most children in the United States go to school on buses, especially in suburban rings where there's low density population, especially in the more affluent suburban rings. There's nothing wrong with buses. They don't have any educational effect, as Jesse Jackson famously said. It's not the bus, it's us. School integration is what we're talking about. But busing is not typically perceived as a burden by the children that experience it. My children were bused to Booker T. Washington School in Champaign, Illinois, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They talked to their friends on the way to school. It wasn't a crisis. It was made into a crisis by politics. But in any case, what we've been dealing with in desegregation since the 1980s, so that means more than 40 years, is mostly about choice plans, how we run them, whether we have magnet schools, whether we have voluntary transfers, whether we have regional cooperation. It's not about mandatory assignment of students, although that was done in the South on a large scale and in some of our cities. And the research on it shows that it was actually beneficial to students of color, and it did not hurt white students, but it did produce extremely explosive politics.
Mm-hmm.
The burden typically was more on the Black and Latino students, and the planners who were responding to the politics tried to minimize the number of white students that were involuntarily transferred. Some places they did it more equitably than others. But the important thing is we have almost none of those plans on large scale plans that are in
right now. Yeah.
And what we're talking about or debating this is setting up different kinds of choice plans that would increase diversity and stabilize diverse neighborhoods, especially things like magnet schools, which almost three quarters of Americans think should be expanded, but we're not expanding them on any significant scale.
Yeah. So in places where we have maintained more school integration, probably because of the makeup of communities, I suspect, in the South, do we see better outcomes? Do we see that African Americans in those schools do better than kids in segregated schools?
Yes, we do see better outcomes. We didn't really know the outcomes very well until quite recently because nobody followed long-term results.
Mm.
They mostly followed test scores. The test scores didn't move that much, although usually they improved significantly. Where Black students had been 3 years behind, they ended up 2 years behind. What really did change, and that nobody really measured much, was what happened to the lives of the students. And it turns out Rucker Johnson at Berkeley, for example, has studied them over generations. And basically the students that were desegregated, depending on how much desegregation they got, had different lives. They're more likely to go to college. They're more likely to finish. They're more likely to live and work in multiracial communities. They're more likely to have higher incomes.
Hmm.
Their health conditions even are better. So, yes, there were major benefits. They're mostly about benefits of life chances rather than benefits of test scores.
Right. Right. And if you think about that, I mean, there's some great irony to that, isn't there?
Yes.
African-Americans moved to cities like Detroit and Chicago and Boston because they were escaping terrible discrimination in the South and attracted to industrial opportunity that had existed in these cities. And overall, of course, the outcomes from a financial perspective have been better for African-Americans who've moved north. It's really interesting that school outcomes, though, are better in the South.
Yeah, I think it's really one of the underlying factors that has led to the fact that Blacks have been moving back to the South now since the 1970s.
Yes, yes.
You know, they're not... Detroit and Chicago aren't the promised land. We're Los Angeles. They're going to the South.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is there's somewhat better interracial contact and opportunities in parts of the South, partly because of civil rights, which really did change the South much more deeply than it changed the North.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, we need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Gary Orfield about school segregation. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you're with us. We're talking today to Gary Orfield, who is a research professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. He co-authored a recent report titled The Unfinished Battle for Integration in a Multiracial America, From Brown to Now. We're talking about school segregation, how much of it is still with us, and what outcomes that is producing. Dr. Orfield, I'm going to start this part of the conversation talking more about Detroit, Metro Detroit. So if you were looking at a map of Detroit and its suburbs and thinking about how to achieve the kind of integration that we might have dreamed of when Brown v. Board of Education was decided, where would you start? What would you do? Would you go back to busing, which was the tool of the 70s? Or are there other things that you would imagine would get us there quicker or more effectively?
Well, I think there's a number of things you can do. The first important thing to do is to say we want to have an integrated society where communities are integrated and the integration lasts and that we can live together and understand each other better. If that becomes a goal, then there's a lot of tools that could be used.
Okay.
And if we're thinking about the suburbs, we need to think about where racial change is going on, where resegregation seems to be threatened, how we can think about regional cooperation, and what new opportunities we can create. Where we have two or three little suburban areas near each other, can we combine them and support some magnet schools that would offer opportunities that don't exist in any of those individual school districts? Mm-hmm. And can we work on race relations in our schools? You know, one of the reasons that neighborhoods change is that conditions aren't good in the schools. The kids are fighting. They're not getting along well. They don't understand each other. People don't feel welcome in the school, one group or another. We know how to make that work better. We know how to train staffs. We know how to create better race relations, make sure that things are done equitably inside of schools. We don't really work on that. All of that's really important. In terms of real estate, I would say, look at what's happening to your housing market. If only Black people or only Latinos are being shown housing in your area, something is wrong and it's a violation of civil rights and it's got to be stopped. And it won't be stopped unless serious energy is put on it, monitoring and prosecuting of racial steering, for example. We need to think about where we want to come out, and there really isn't a viable future except lasting integration, unless we want to go through endless rounds of resegregation. And we need to think about how we can take the problem and make it into opportunities by creating broader and more interesting options for students, and supporting them in a way that conflicts are eliminated and understanding grows. It won't happen unless we decide we want it to happen. But if we don't decide it, well, it'll be huge cost because none of the families will get what they wanted. The Black families that left Detroit want to have a stable middle class neighborhood. They don't want to be in a resegregated neighborhood with a lot where most of the kids are poor. The white families that live there want the same kind of thing. They won't get it unless there's a plan, some serious effort to make that happen.
I want to note that one thing you did not mention is forced deseg, forced integration, and I wonder.
I was in favor of it. We can't get it now. There's no way we can get it because the Supreme Court has made it impossible with its decisions. But there's a lot we can do with other tools that we need to do.
Would forced integration work? Hey, let's say you could change the Supreme Court's mind, probably not this particular Supreme Court.
It depends on how you do it.
Yeah.
If you send all the kids to majority middle-class schools and support them well, it certainly can work. I was involved in Louisville where it's worked. It worked for more than 50 years without a court order because it was actually successful, and the students and the parents liked the results, and so did the community leaders. The business leaders said you could hire people from any school. They knew how to work together. You know, it where it works. You know, I did a study of a suburb outside of Chicago, mm-hmm. Oak Park. It's been integrated now for 60 years. Everybody wants to live there. The housing market draws people from every racial background. It has a very good schools. You know, they made it work. They decided how they wanted to come out, and they took after every element that produced resegregation. Like the way sleazy businesses move into areas that are beginning to go through racial change, they stopped it. They worked with their realtors and they said, you know, if people want to move into our community, if they're white, show them some houses in black areas. If they're black, show them some houses in white areas. You know, expand their possibilities rather than constrict them.
Yeah, I guess one of the things I'm trying to get at here, though, is whether you think the country is willing to indulge integration and the idea of kind of multiracial communities and institutions, or whether it still needs to be pushed, kind of shoved toward that in order to kind of break through these barriers that, as you point out, are about not knowing, are about not understanding the value of these things, or is there a balance that you got to strike between those two things?
Well, I think there's a balance, and in the best of worlds, we would have our courts pushing us to think about a way to do this, and communities working on positive ways, turning lemons into lemonade. Right now, we have courts that are destroying civil rights. You know, the Supreme Court has eliminated affirmative action last year. It's really radically reduced the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. It's hostile to civil mm-hmm. rights. It's the most conservative Supreme Court we've had in at least 80 years. The Supreme Court isn't going to do it. That's why in Minnesota and New Jersey right now, they're trying to get state courts to do it. I think that is a possibility in states that have good state Supreme Courts. But for the moment, most of it, this is on us. It's on us to try to make our school and housing policies and our urban planning work differently. Mm-hmm. And there isn't much leadership about it. But if you, one of the reasons we do these reports is to show that what happens if you don't do anything. If you don't do anything, we're going to have a very polarized society, and a lot of the talent in our society isn't going to be developed, and the race relations are going to be bad. And we know what bad race relations look like because we have politics that are just stirring up bad race relations in our country, and it's incredibly destructive to the future of communities.
Yeah.
So if you look at where we're going, it's not a viable future. Understanding that is part of the process we need to go through. The next part is saying where we want to go, what kind of society we'd like to have. Do we have workable examples of that? Yes, we do. Are we going to have any leadership about it? That's where the people who run our school systems need to think about this in a creative way. We also need to think about how this could play a role in revitalization of our central cities. Every big city in California is now having a lot of gentrification. Mm-hmm. People are moving back to the city. And I know there's small areas of Detroit where that's happening. It won't happen on scale where you get middle-class families of all races moving back from the suburbs to the central city unless you can offer viable integrated schools. They won't come.
Yeah.
But if you want them to come and stay and to support your central city, you need to figure out how to offer them schools where their kids will not be isolated and they will be prepared for college. That's a challenge that most of our central city school systems haven't met yet, but it's also a big opportunity for them if they meet it successfully.
So last question. If you had to hold up a community that you think is kind of a beacon of kind of hope around this idea, this ideal of integrated schools and what they produce for not only black and brown students, but also for white students, what community would that be?
Well, one of the communities I look at is Berkeley, California, which is a university town, but it has a very poor black community. Mm-hmm. They've been integrated voluntarily now since 1965. They don't produce complete equality, but those students of color that go to those schools tend to do much better in lives than students who go to segregated schools in Oakland or someplace else. I think about Connecticut, where you have regional magnet schools in all of the metros, where kids of all races want to go and where there's waiting lists. Why don't we do that? That's an improving opportunity rather than constricting it and producing opportunities for kids who will not get ready for college if they're in a segregated, high-poverty, inner-city school, to get ready to go to any college in the country. We can figure out, that's not rocket science to do, and it doesn't constrict anybody's opportunity. It just takes leadership, and it takes willingness to invest some resources, but it can produce much better outcomes. Yeah. We don't have a lot of big examples of this because the politics and the developments have been negative, but they do exist, and we did learn a lot in the desegregation era, and we could do much better. And if we don't do it, it's on us, because we're going in a path that doesn't work. We know it won't work. So let's think about having some leadership to expand the opportunities for a much more constructive relationship between kids of different racial and ethnic groups. We're not giving these kids a fair chance. We're not doing some things that would make our communities work better in the future. We're not developing a lot of our talent. We can do a lot better.
Yeah. Okay, Gary Arfield, it was really great to have you here for this conversation on Created Equal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Good to talk to you.
So I guess my question then is, going into this conversation, my thought was the goal of desegregation, at least initially, was about resources and educational resources.
Yes.
Now it seems it's about both resources, but also experience, variety of, you know, intermingling with other cultures. It's more than just the resources element. Because for me, yes, I'm not saying that integration is a bad thing. I'm not.
Right.
But I do think that prioritizing those resources to your community is, to me, the most direct way that that's going to happen. And that's in trying to find different schools, I think it's a great way to a long-term solution, right? You're investing in the young folks so that they get the resources they need, so then going forward they can flourish.
Right.
But it doesn't take away the idea that the community still needs resources. Immediate resources.
Right, it doesn't. It's just that it's a lot harder to address that.
Right.
Because
this is one way.
People choose to live in a segregated world.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, I mean, black people, white people.
Right.
People want to live in a community where people look like them. And as long as that's true, integrated schools are really difficult and maybe impossible goal. We're leaning on schools to solve a problem that's about adults.
Right, right.
Right.
And I think that's my biggest
disconnection. We're saying, we can't solve this problem where adults don't want to live in integrated communities. Mm-hmm. So we're going to force
the kids,
or try to force
the
kids to attend school in an integrated fashion. And it works in some cases and it doesn't in most.
Right.
That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.